here on WWTV 860 AM. We're now pleased to have a pre-recorded interview with Ksenia Svitlova, former member of Knesset, and now a researcher at the Interdisciplinary Center in Israel, speaking about Russia, Middle East affairs.
Lebanon, Syria, Libya, Egypt, and the Palestinian territories. A specialist, she, in 2019, authored her first book, Through Middle East on Heels, the Pardes Publishing House. Ksenia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Greg. Good to be here.
And thank you for joining us. And we really have to talk right now about news that's developed in the last 48 hours as it relates to the article that you wrote on May 14th, Why the Kremlin is Not Giving Up on Assad, and other murmurs from the Saudis, from the Israelis, from the Kurds to a certain extent, of why Bashar al-Assad's position as dictator of Syria, 9 years after the end of the civil war, may be in jeopardy. What's going on?
Yes, so let me begin from the beginning. A few weeks ago, a surprising survey was published by one of the Russian media outlets that belongs to the so-called Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin, an oligarch, a very powerful man, very close man to Putin. And the survey basically said that Syrians do not trust anymore Bashar Assad, and he's unlikely candidate to win in the elections of 2021 that are scheduled for, they were scheduled for April, and now they were moved to June. So for anybody who reads the survey, of course, you know, there are many, many question marks there. So since when do we have a democratic elections in Syria, in which the acting president cannot win. Okay, so this is first. Second, how can you really make a survey now in Syria, considering that, you know, the very pitiful situation in this country? And third, what was the purpose, you know, for which this survey was published by an anonymous media outlet that belongs to this very, very powerful man? So many experts, especially in the Gulf, but I would say that also in the United States, have jumped immediately to the conclusion that this is it, enough is enough, and Russia, that was not infatuated with Bashar Assad from the beginning, is probably, you know, wishes to get rid of him and probably wants to do it prior to the presidential elections. The problem with this assumption is that, first of all, that in Russia there is only one center of power that and that acts, you know, in the that has total control of the situation. This is first. And there are instead of that, you know, I would suggest that in Russia we have many centers of power, and some of them are working for, to promote their own interests, especially when we are talking about business interests. So Prigozhin has many business interests in oil specifically, but also others in Syria. He was not as successful in promoting them as he would wish. And one of the assumptions is that the survey was summoned by him in order to pressure Bashar Assad for his own benefit, also for the benefit of his master, President Putin. But we do not talk right now at any possibility of exclusion of Assad, removal of Assad from power, simply because there is no substitute for the Russians. They need some source that will give them legitimacy for their presence in Syria. Assad is giving them this, you know, so-called legitimacy, if we can talk about this at all, because he invited the Russians to intervene for him in 2015. It was formal cry for help. And anybody who will replace him will not be, he will not own his life and his survival to the Russians as he does. Okay, so it's a catch-22. With Assad, the Russians cannot rebuild Syria. They cannot improve the economical situation there because everything is stuck. Nobody will help Syria when Assad is there. But without Assad, they lose their legitimacy. So for now, they're stuck with this dictator, a person who is responsible for murdering 500,000 of his own people, exiling millions of others. They understand very well who he is, and they might despise him, but for now, Assad is staying.
Can we go through a checklist of who the Russians have to deal with in Syria besides the Assad family? They've got the Kurds, They've got the Turks. To a certain extent, they have to deal with the Iraqis. And they have to deal with Israel and the Americans. And let's not forget Iran. Why don't you walk through those six parties and the Russian relationship with each one and how that might be affecting their decision of what to do with Assad?
So until now, Russians were extremely successful in having good relations with all the parties that are involved in the Syrian conflict. There were jiggling between the between Turkey and Iran, despite you know, having all of these countries having conflicting interests in Syria. Very good working relations with Israel. Israel, you know, woke up one day and we found out that we became a neighbor of Russia in our northern border, you know. So it was particularly striking for people like me who originally, you know, made Aliyah from Russia in the beginning of the 90s. Yeah? So suddenly the country that you left, you're becoming, it becomes your neighbor once again. It worked well until, I would say, the end of autumn 2019, because the problems began when Russians had to somehow deal with the issue of Idlib in northeastern Syria. This province now has about 3 million people who are, you know, citizens who are just stuck there because they happen to live there. They have all of the representation of all possible jihadists and oppositional organizations who are also, you know, they poured into Idlib because they were just forced, you know, from everywhere else. They are now protected by Turkey. So Russia has to accommodate Turkey concern for having extra 3 million refugees. It already hosts 2 million refugees spends a lot of money to taking care of them. This is also the issue of influence. Okay, the Turks would not, you know, be willing to give up their influence in this part of the land. It is strategic for them. They will not go away. You know, so the Russians understood at this moment that Turkey is it will be not an easy party to just you know, have a solution for it. Actually, there is no solution so much for Egypt, and we can see it now. They are going from one ceasefire to another. While the objective, of course, is to regain all of the Syrian land eventually for the Assad family, for the Assad's regime. How to reconcile it with the desire of Turks to have this area of domination, also because of the Kurdish issue. I would say that the Kurds were, of course, forced after the, you know, U.S. Withdrawal of its forces from northeastern Syria. They were forced to go back to Moscow and to beg for their protection. Okay, so again, a win for Russia. For the Kurds, it's not something new that they are in the position where they have to beg for protection, they have to beg for their lives. Now, there is two other actors, it's Iran and Israel. Okay, so this is a very interesting game that the Russians are playing right now in Syria. They are allowing for the Israeli Air Force, and we are talking about, you know, for them basically not retaliating for any of the strikes that happened during the last month, and there was a serious increase in the strikes against the Iranian and pro-Iranian targets in different parts of Syria. When the Iranians are, you know, coming to them and they're basically accusing them of not operating their systems, the S-300, they're saying that, well, you know, you brought all of the systems, air defense systems, but they are worthless because you do not operate them. You know, you and not the Syrians have the right to operate the systems. So the Russians make themselves as they do not understand, they do not want to really hear, you know, all of these complaints. The Iranians are partners, but they're also rivals in Syria. There are conflicting business interests. There is a lot, you know, what they can fight for in the sphere of also the rebuilding of Syria and also, of course, the energy sector. So when the war is almost over now, okay, so the Russians do not need the Iranians as much as they used to need them. They still are not willing to actively do anything to ban them from Syria. They cannot really uproot them from Syria. It's impossible. Iran is too deeply rooted in the Syrian soil, economically, military. They are moving populations from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, and they are resettling them in Syria. So this is also ethnic cleansing and population exchange. This is what is happening in this miserable country. So, again, this is the, I think, masterpiece of Russian diplomacy. From one side, you know, they are using the Iranians to fight the battles. They do not put as much soldiers on the ground as you would think. It's not a very expensive expedition for them. From the other side, also Israel is happy because, you know, what the foreign media outlets attribute to Israel, all of this activity that happened during the last month, last 2 weeks, this is happening with full knowledge of Russian military that is sitting in Syria.
Right, but there's also been some rough spots between Israel and Russia. For instance, the downing of a Tupolev 22 Russian military aircraft off the coast of Syria by a Syrian anti-air missile, but ostensibly as a result of a lack of coordination between the Israeli Air Force and the Russian air defense systems on the ground, and the Syrian air defense systems, rather, on the ground. So what are the Israelis and the Russians doing to deconflict any conflict over the skies of Syria?
So I would say that the deconfliction is basically working extremely well. But then again, it's only deconfliction. It's not a cooperation. Israel has one strategic partner in the world, and this is the United States. You know, let me be very clear about it. This is not an O-O game. You know, either you know we are going to the United States or we're going now with Russia. There is no other option. Our strategic partner is the United States. We have to, however, have some kind of cooperation in the deconfliction center with the Russians to prevent exactly this type of tragedies that happened last year. Unfortunately, the Russian side decided to blame Israel for the fault of their Syrian clients. And it seems to me, because I was following very closely the coverage of this incident in the Russian media, somebody in the defense ministry was particularly eager to have this anti-Israeli, I would say even anti-Semitic campaign that was launched at that moment. And then, you know, it suddenly stopped at once after a few weeks of very vicious coverage and blames and even threats that came from the direction of the defense ministry. Suddenly, when Putin intervened and there was this reconciliation conversation between him and between Netanyahu, the prime minister, suddenly it all was, you know, abruptly ended. So no more, you know, grudges, no more hate, and so on. But, you know, we are not mistaken. We know that if anything remotely of this kind will happen again, then again, you know, even if it will be the fault of, I don't know, Iranians or the Syrian military or whatever, but the Russian soldiers will, you know, suffer. The Russians are very, very clear about it. Okay, so they, it seems that once again, that Israel will be held responsible, even if it really didn't help a direct involvement in this kind of incidents. And this is, of course, a worrying reality. But then again, you know, this is not something that we can change or we can alter. This is the reality. Russia is the dominant power in Syria. It became even more dominant now when U.S. Almost removed all of its forces from Syria. And it will remain there, never mind the COVID-19 crisis, economic crisis that they're facing there. They are not going anywhere. Just to remind you that they chartered the Tartus seaport for the next 49 years. And they're investing now $500 million in reshaping and restructuring this port, so it will also accommodate their needs of their military.
And they never really had a significant naval presence outside of Russian borders, except in Tartus. That was a deal that was signed in the 70s?
Exactly. This is a dream come true.
Right. Now it's a deep water port. They can accommodate, what, like 18 ships of the Russian Navy?
We already see the exercises that they perform close to the shores of Lebanon and to Syria. And it seems that they are about to fulfill the long-time Russian dream since the days of Peter I, and certainly from the days of the Soviet Union, and have their own Mediterranean fleet. I don't know to which part of the Russian Navy it will belong, but this is something that is it's work in progress. Okay, so they already have a word in the Mediterranean. They already have their influence over the course of events that will happen there, and of course the proximity to Northern Alliance members and to everything that is going on in Europe. It's extremely important. I think that it's. This point is being basically underestimated because I saw that many American outlets had published since the beginning of the year, you know, Foreign Affairs wrote about it, also Foreign Policy, saying that, you know, the Russian power in the Middle East is on decline. They only just begun. They're, you know, playing a long-term game and nobody is going anywhere. Although they are not progressing perhaps as quickly as, you know, they would want to in the Gulf specifically. Also in Egypt, you know, there are conflicting news now about selling the Su-35 jets to
right,
Egypt.
The Sukhoi-35, the equivalent of the fifth generation American aircrafts.
Yes. So Egypt was already notified by the Pentagon that there will be ramifications for this kind of deal. And it was, you know, it seemed that for a while that they are not going to go for this for this deal. Maybe, you know, postpone it or, you know, maybe even cancel it. Now there are some reports also from Russia and unconfirmed reports from Egypt that this deal is proceeding. So if it will indeed it will be accomplished, it will be a clear sign that you know, things are going on. Things are going on, and they are able to basically promote their influence and to project their power in the Middle East.
Now, we have a report here from Defense News that the Gagarin aircraft plant in Khamsa-Ask on Amur is starting production as of yesterday, according to the TASS agency. And the Egyptians are on slate to get a few dozen aircraft, 24 aircraft. I wonder how that's going to go, you know, head-to-head with the Israeli F-35. Let's get to a place of personal interest for you for a second. When you were a member of Knesset from 2015 to 2019, you were the chairwoman of the caucus for the strengthening of relations between the State of Israel and the Kurdish people. Less on the Israel side, more on the Kurdish side. How are the Russians dealing with the, how are the Kurds dealing with the Russian presence in Syria?
So since the beginning of the Russian involvement in 2015, the Kurds, specifically the SDF, they received signals from Moscow. They were invited for discussions. They were inviting for cooperation. And they basically they were told that at the moment when the Americans will be leaving, and at that moment, who could imagine that in 2015, 2016, you will be handling the Turks alone. So, guys, you have to reconsider your alliances. You need us. You need us, so you will need us even more when the Americans will be leaving. And this is exactly what happened. Now, Russians were involved with the issue of the, you know, Kurdish struggle for quite some time. You know, there is also substantial Kurdish population in the Russian Federation, which is interesting, yes. So, and the Kurds had relations also with the Communist Party during the Soviet time, and they were used as also leverage against Turkey, which was, you know, straight NATO member and ally of the West for many, many years until recently. So sometimes this Kurdish card, well, everybody plays the Kurdish card, unfortunately. These people, in my opinion, deserve their state no less and perhaps even more than many, many other people who also are fighting for their sovereignty and really they suffered for so long. I believe that it will be of justice if the state of the nations, they will support their cause regardless of the political game. But this is real life. So in real life, you have all kinds of political alliances and usually it's alliances. In Russian, you say it's against, you have to be friends with somebody against somebody else. Okay, so in this regard, the Kurds were cooperating with the Soviet Union in the 60s and the 70s, less so in the recent years of the Soviet Union. And then again, with Russia, you have this strategic dialogue that is ongoing. The Kurds understand that they are not the favorites. They are not Moscow's favorite because there are not much gains, you know, from cooperation with them at the moment. But again, it's part of the Russian strategy. Keep everybody more or less happy and dependent on you. So the Kurds are exactly in this position right now. They are dependent on Moscow, and they basically they have only one address right now in Syria with whom they can cooperate to protect them against the Turks.
All right, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here. Okay. The focus of Russia, we've covered Iran, we've covered Israel, we've covered the Assad family, we've covered the Kurds. But what do the Russians get out of a permanent presence in Syria in terms of economic gain? We talked about Tartus and the Air Force Base, which we didn't mention, but they're going to have an air presence there too. What do they get economically from Syria that they don't have right now?
So for now, the Russians are not getting as much from Syria in contrast with what they planned to have. You have a number of oligarchs, and specifically Prigozhin, whom we discussed already, that help the Russian state to be more successful in the wars that it wages in different parts of the world. So specifically Prigozhin, he is an owner of the so-called Wagner security company. And the Wagners are fighting along with the Russian soldiers. It's something that Russia doesn't recognize.
Let's just give the audience a real quick history on Wagner. Active in Russia, active in Libya, active in disinformation campaigns against the United States.
Active in Central African Republic, active in many other places in the world where there are military and economic interests that Russia pursues. But it doesn't pursue it with the hands of its own military or its own soldiers, but rather with the hands of private people, private security companies that are owned by oligarchs who are very, very close to Kremlin. So in Syria, companies such as Wagner, who lost many, many of their people, that they are talking now, many hundreds of people who are Wagner operatives who were killed in battles. Various battlefields in Syria, and the reward should be, of course, it should be rights for exploiting the gas fields, the oil fields. So Prigozhin actually got the rights for the oil field next to Palmyra in central Syria, and he signed the contracts in the beginning of this year. It was reported that he signed the contracts in January. But it seems that the Syrian bureaucracy and the kleptocratic regime that is in power and the interests of Iranians, they are all overlapping the interests of the Russian companies. So they are unable for now to extract any value from the contracts that they sign. You have also other oligarchs that have contracts, for other sectors, so phosphates, and other, things that you can find in Syria. And they're all complaining that the gain is not that significant and that they have to compete with the Iranians, who it seems that, being a little bit more successful in the financial sphere than the Russians. Okay, so we are talking basically natural resources. This is what Syria can offer. Nobody is standing in line to rebuild Syria because you need to invest money for that. And who would want to do that at the moment?
Think about that for a second. Think about this pipeline, okay? So just as an imaginary situation, the Russians help finish the job at Idlib. They reach some kind of accord with the Turks and the Syrians and Hezbollah and anyone else involved, all the different Islamist entities that are there. And then Assad calls a peace conference or a reconstruction conference. Billions of dollars are raised to rebuild Syria. And here you go, at the front of the line are a bunch of Russian oligarchs and their construction companies, concrete, oil, gas, food, job training, whatever else, waiting with their hands out for basically building the New Syria on the destruction that they caused. It's quite an operation.
It's quite an operation, only nobody at the moment is ready to put even $1 to invest in the future of Syria, because until Bashar Assad is there, you have this united position of also Europe, also United States. The majority of Arab Gulf countries, apart perhaps the United Arab Emirates, they have their own agenda, but they are not willing. And also China. China is important here because China would be the, you know, the immediate suspect of who can put the money. Yes, of you know, this kind. You need $350 billion to regain, you know, Syria, to rebuild Syria. So China is not eager as well. China is not part of those who would want to jump into this infested by terror and myriad of conflicts, ethnic, religious, political conflicts land, and just offer their assistance. So for now, it seems that until Bashar Assad is there, and I think it was made quite clear last year when the Russians tried to promote through the UN this constitutional committee thing, and to make an appearance of, you know, some political process that is happening in Syria, and was so unconvincing, it was so weak, that I think that many of the countries just made it clear that there is no rebuilding on Syria, there is no effort to invest, you know, money or to do something until Bashar Assad is there. So this is the catch-22 that we were referring to in the beginning of our conversation. Until Assad is there, you cannot really do much. You cannot move the stone that is called Syria today from one side to another. But when Assad will be gone, then also Russian legitimacy might be jeopardized. And this is something that I'm not sure that anybody in Moscow was willing to risk.
Ksenia Svetlova, former member of the Israeli Knesset and senior policy analyst at the Institute for Policy and Strategy at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Shalom.
And I'm Greg Roman here on WWDB 860 AM. We'll see you next week.